of dominated sports conversation at work, then you've come to the right place. These two are the kings of sports talk at work.
This is The Big Show with Matt and Zach.
Welcome to another edition of The Big Show with Matt and Zach. I'm Matt Amston. He's Zach Spears.
What's up?
We're coming to you from downtown Dallas, Texas. Brought to you today by Amston's Famous Ribs and Brisket. Check online for a location near you. On today's show, we'll be overreacting to NFL Week 1 and all the action. We're going to take a look at the fantasy forecast for Week 2 and how our predictions have gone thus far from preseason draft rankings and Week 1. And then we'll take a look at some of the early Heisman favorites in college football and some of the other major news and notes that have been going around the league. Zach, let's kick off with what is probably our favorite topic, the NFL.
Yes.
Week 1 has come and gone already. It's unbelievable. Let's talk about your Cowboys. Week 1, got a win, but in my eyes, it was almost a loss.
I think it was a loss. I've told my dad, and I've told other people this, I would rather lose that game than lose Dez Bryant for 3 months, as it looks like now, with the broken foot, than lose one of your top pass rushers, especially why Hardy's out, and Randy Gregory, the rookie who looked phenomenal all throughout preseason and through the game, lost him for a month. And then Ronald Leary strained his groin, didn't play the entire fourth quarter. He's the weak link on the offensive line, but you never want to lose your starting offensive line, especially on that Dallas Cowboys offensive line. That's great.
Right.
So you've lost him for 1 to 3 weeks. He didn't play any of the fourth quarter. He'd be smart to sit out this week, you know, so he can be as healthy as possible moving forward. I would feel a lot better going into this Philadelphia game if Dez Bryant was healthy, watching the Philadelphia Eagles try to cover the talented wide receivers of the Falcons from last night, which was atrocious, but I loved it as a Cowboys fan. Now, as far as the game goes, I thought the Cowboys had money on the game trying to beat themselves. Like, it was that bad. The Cowboys were had to depend on other people they've never had to depend on, really, in Devin Street because Dez was out with the cramps and then broke his foot, having to depend on running backs that have never really toted an entire game. And the running backs did all right. The running backs actually, you know, produced. We got a lot of production of them out of the backfield catching the football, which I think we're going to see a lot of. Offensive line played great, as we all expected. And the defense did their best that they could. They were put in some tough situations sometimes, and the scoreboard doesn't actually indicate how well the defense played since the offense gave up some of those points, really. So, overall, I was pleased, but, you know, going into halftime, the Cowboys are down, but you feel like they're actually up, like, 17-7 or something like that, because they dominated. At one point in time in the fourth quarter, I looked up the stats. The Cowboys had over 100 yards more than the Giants. They had 24 more minutes of time of possession, 10 more first downs. They were killing them. The scoreboard, they were losing. And then, luckily, it looked like the Giants ultimately had money on the game to lose and really foobarred their way out of the game.
Yeah. Now, before we get to the end of the game and kind of giving our opinion on what we saw there, I got to ask you this. Like, watching that first half for me was like watching paint dry. Like, that was a very boring game. Both sides, just mistakes, extremely slow pace, which surprised me because Linehan comes more from a little more up-tempo, likes to pass the ball, move it around, and it seemed like he was trying to force himself to run the ball a lot because that's what the Cowboys want to do. And in the second half, when they were down or needed to score and ran a little bit more up tempo and let Tony kind of run and stay in control, they produced so much better because the defense started to get on their heels and started to open up a lot more holes. You know, where do you think this team goes from here? Now, number one, losing Dez, you know, are they going to go ultra conservative, two tight ends, and just try to grind games out and win with a bunch of field goals? Or do you think now they've kind of forced themselves to, okay, we got to let Tony open this up and dink and dunk our way through here? Where do you think this team goes week two?
Yeah. So to your first point, the reason why you're seeing the Cowboys just mosey their way down the football field is that's how they beat teams. Their defense has struggled. They built this offensive line and this entire offense to hog the clock. And it's you take away time off the clock, you're also taking away possessions off of teams. You know, the Cowboys dominate time of possession. They had 15, 20 more plays than the other team. That's 3 or 4 possessions, which could account for, you know, 28 points of the other team. So that is the reason why Linehan sticks to the run. And that's why you've seen that last year. That's how the Cowboys beat a lot of teams with the terrible defense that they had. Now, what you're going to see, I believe, moving forward with Dez out is this kind of, you're going to have to stick to the run. You're going to have to trust it and what you pay your offensive lineman for. What they've done in the past is 4 yards in a cloud of dust, running the football, taking up the time. When they need a big play or need everyone to respect the running game, throw a slant to Dez. But most of the time, the formula for success for Dallas, and has been, is 4 yards in a cloud of dust into the red zone, and then you open it up. And you start throwing fades to Dez, get Witten out in the open, Beasley on some type of interesting route combination, and get those guys open. And that's how the Cowboys have been able to score points and are so dynamic, because you never can commit to anything, because Romo's smart enough to check at the line and get the ball to a playmaker, whether it's in the running or the pass game. With Dez, your most complete weapon outside, it really closes everything in, because the defense can totally commit to the run if the run's working. Now, if the pass is working, they don't have to yet respect the run. They can totally commit to protecting themselves against the pass, because you don't have a weapon like Dez Bryant out there. Interesting moving forward, but I do think the smart bet would be use your three running backs in your offensive line and see if you can get something going in the running game.
Okay, so let's go back to how the Giants-Cowboys game ended. So to set it up for those who may not have seen, you know, what we're describing here, 4 minutes to go, the Giants are up three and take possession. They go into what we'll call their four-minute offense. They want to get 2-3 first downs, milk the clock. Cowboys have all three timeouts at this point. Run a couple plays, get a first down. Run a couple plays, get a first down.
And they want Dallas to use up all their timeouts.
Yep. So they get a couple first downs, then Rashad Jennings pops a 25-yard gain, gets down to about the 4 or 5-yard line. So you're thinking this game's on ice, right? Cowboys burn one timeout. We got about 2:15 left to go, so the Cowboys have two timeouts and the 2-minute warning. Maybe they can get the ball back. You're hoping they can hold them for a field goal here. Next play runs, and there was the illegal formation. So the big thing there, the clock stopped because of the penalty. The Cowboys had stopped the play, so it became 2nd and 9. They declined the penalty, so they wouldn't give him another down, and they stopped the clock. Essentially a free timeout.
Mm-hmm.
The next play was a holding. It moves them back 10 yards, right? And
yep.
And so then it stops the clock again. Cowboys yep. don't have to burn a timeout. Run the ball up the middle. They call a timeout. And then on 3rd down, they decide to pass the ball. Eli Manning rolls out. Barry Church locks up with Larry Donnell. You know, and I heard a lot of people say if he had thrown it anywhere near Larry Donnell, it probably would have been called pass interference.
Yeah.
But Eli decided to put the ball 10 rows up in the stands and stop the clock again. So the Cowboys now are sitting there like, okay, we got our timeouts, and what are they going to do? Kick a field goal?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Kick a field goal. Go up 6. Give us the ball back. So maybe break down from your perspective, Zach, what went wrong there? What options might have they had on the table there to secure this victory or put themselves in a higher probability position to get a win?
Well, first of all, the running back Jennings was told by Peyton Manning and seconded by Eli Manning and seconded by the Giants coaching staff to not score. But if my math serves me correctly, you score, whether you get the extra point or not, you're up 9 to 10 points, 2 possessions, and there's 1:33 left on the clock when mm-hmm. Dallas gets the ball. And Dallas has minimal timeouts, if any, by the time that's all through. Cowboys aren't beating you. You come into Dallas and you steal a game. Like, you literally steal a game that you have no business winning and that Dallas dominated you in. And so you would hope – I'm not a Giants fan by any stretch of the imagination, but my offensive mind tells me in football to be smart and run the football there. You don't get it. You don't score. You kick the field goal, and you're right where you were anyways, but you've wasted another 50 seconds off the clock, which proved to be the difference in this ball game. Or you tell Eli to roll out and to throw the ball, and if it's not there, you slide inbounds. You stay in. There's nothing wrong with throwing the ball there, but if the pass isn't there, if it's not open, you have to do the right thing. That's to get down or to get it to somebody who can get down. Now, that's the situation there. And I just find it just outlandish that a Manning bloodline, a guy that just 3 days before the game paid $85 million. He's won 2 Super Bowls. And the guy knows everything about football. His entire family's encyclopedia. And Eli is a smart football player. Would tell someone, not to score a touchdown to go up two possessions at the end of a football game, in a division game. It doesn't make any sense to me. What did you think when you heard that?
Yeah, I thought it was crazy. I mean, I think there's a time and a place where, okay, let's not score. And I think we saw this maybe, gosh, Tiki Barber, you know, 10 years ago where he took a knee at the one, or MJD for the Jags when he took a knee at the one, you know, because they got the first down and now could take three knees to ice the game.
Yes.
In this scenario,
there's no way they could run out the clock.
Right.
There's too much time.
There weren't enough downs. There were too many timeouts and the two-minute warning. They couldn't have just run out the game by not scoring. So it didn't make sense to me. I think.
And if you only go up three, you're not even up one possession.
Correct. Yeah. You're only up six at that point. So a touchdown still ties the game. And assuming Dan Bailey can bang home the extra point,
they win the game.
Yeah, you lose. So that the don't get in was kind of a head scratcher, you know, in hindsight from what we heard post game. In game, you know, not burning that extra 40 seconds by throwing the ball out of bounds. Because if you go from a minute 50 left on the clock when you're getting the ball versus a minute 10, that is a huge difference. And the Cowboys, in all honesty, needed every second to do that. And let's really kind of lay all the cards out there. If I got a minute 10, I'm going to take more chances.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to force the ball down the field. I'm going to need large chunk plays versus with 2 minutes, I can do a little more dink and dunk.
Yeah.
I can take, hey, 15 yards to Witten down the middle. Check down to Dunbar. Take 7 yards. Okay, quick out of bounds. Okay, let's reset. Here are the next 2-3 plays. Let's go chunk.
Instead of throwing every route to someone who is stimming out of bounds. Yeah, it's close to out of bounds.
Out of bounds or forcing it. Okay, I need 30 yards going down the seam. Then we're in spike mode, right? So maybe they would have lost either way. We'll never really know at this point, but I felt like it was just complete mismanagement, and they gave the game to the Cowboys ultimately.
And I was listening to Philadelphia Sports Radio today, and we'll get to their game later, but they were talking, some Cowboys fans were calling in to their radio station, and they were talking trash to the Cowboys fans about the Giants gift-wrapped you a game, where me watching the game, I felt like the Cowboys virtually gift-wrapped the Giants a game. And the Philadelphia sports radio guys were saying that the Cowboys and Cowboys fans should not feel good about this win, where the only thing I don't like about this win is that we left the game really hurt.
Yeah.
Like, some of our best players are hurt. But I feel good about the win because we won a game that we actually did win. We dominated everything, and we were lucky enough to have at least one more point than the other team. It would have been far more devastating to lose this ball game that you absolutely dominated. And then not saying it's not devastating for Giants because they had the game in their hand and they literally let the Cowboys have it. But I do feel like the Cowboys, for 98% of the game, outplayed them. And if it weren't for that, I'd feel really, really bad about this moving forward. But the Cowboys played well enough besides the two turnovers to beat just about anyone in the NFL, I feel like, with the things that they were doing on both sides of the ball, especially if you're taking up 32 minutes of time of possession in a game, you know, or even more than that. If you don't turn the ball over, you're going to win against most opponents.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you can't complain about getting a win any time in the NFL, whether it's luck, whether you dominate, whether a team hands you a game. You take a win whenever you can get it. You know, the Cowboys in this instance, they got number one out of the way. It's going to be a tough, tough stretch here with the bodies that they've lost. And so they needed every win they could get at this point because it's going to be a struggle. And you've got a tough schedule upcoming, so until you can get some of those reinforcements back, it's going to be a tough hill to climb for the Cowboys.
Can we talk about your Seahawks? We dissected my Cowboys win. Your Seahawks, we talked about the last 2 weeks that this would be a tough game on the road in St. Louis, an up-and-coming St. Louis team. You're our Seahawks expert. Mm-hmm. Tell me, first and foremost, your game thoughts of week one for your Hawks.
High level, again, we knew it was going to be a really tough matchup. Anytime you have a division game on the road to open your season, especially against a team up and coming and with a ton of talent, is going to be a challenge, whether you're the Super Bowl champions or you're the worst team in the NFL the year prior. The Rams, for whatever reason, play the Seahawks really tough, and I think part of that is the design of how strong their front seven is. They just stuff Marshawn Lynch.
Donald looked really good.
He was good. We've had, you know, dealt with Chris Long and Robert Quinn and James Laurinaitis for how many years? I mean, those guys are just stacked across the front in all, you know, four or five positions there.
And it doesn't help that the Seattle offensive line is about as bad as it gets right now in the NFL. Your star quarterback was sacked six times.
Yeah, and you know, when we had a good offensive line, the Rams still got after it, but it made it even worse that, like you mentioned,
helpless.
We have a patchwork offensive line, a bunch of young guys. We've got rookies starting, and okay, game one, guys, you're going to go against one of the best defensive fronts in the entire NFL.
And then I go online, I'm reading quotes, and like a week and a half ago, your offensive line coach said this may be one of the best offensive line he's coached in his time in Seattle.
Tom Cable's losing his mind.
If that's the case, I would agree. There's nothing there. I mean, Marshawn at the end of the game didn't stand a chance.
No. Like, if you didn't see the play, so, well, fast forward. We're in overtime. Yeah. The game's tied. Rams kick a field goal. We get the ball back. We're driving down the field. We get to about the 40. Ends up being 4th-and-1. I think everyone in the stadium and everyone around the world knew in principle the Seahawks were going to run the ball.
Yeah, like, you have to after the Super Bowl.
After the last 4 months of, like, worst decision ever, worst call ever, like, they were going to run the ball. And as soon as Russell Wilson got in shotgun with Marshawn next to him, it was like, okay, it's either read option or he's going to run a slow draw right up the middle. So there were probably 9 guys around the line of scrimmage. I think everyone's crashing, shooting gaps. Marshawn didn't stand a chance.
What? Let's talk about how we got to that point in overtime.
Okay.
The surprise onside to start the halftime. I was on air with former NFL quarterback Sean Salisbury, and he hated the call, saying that it took away the number one strength for Seattle. What they've built this franchise upon in winning games is the defense. You handicap the defense, giving an NFL team the ball on that side of the 50-yard line is automatically at least 3 points, and that's what they got. And so the Hawks automatically had to score something in the games over and overtime. Right. Take us through your thought process on there and what you've kind of what you figured out since.
I was ready to throw some stuff.
Were you out at dinner?
Buffalo Wild Wings, and I think a lot of people, you know,
you texted me stupid.
Yeah, didn't appreciate what I thought about it in a family environment.
That's their fault for being there on a Sunday.
Exactly. So I the choice at the time, you see a little pooch kick come from Hauschka. It goes about 15 yards. The guy fair catches it, falls down, and the referees were confused. Was it an illegal fair catch?
It was.
Was it? Did he kick it off the ground? Did he just pop it in the air? But then the Seahawks all smashed the guy who called a fair catch. So the whole thing was a circus. I don't think anyone knew what to do. They end up just kind of ruling, let the play
stand.
And
this is the start overtime. This isn't like – this isn't after the Seahawks have scored. This is – at 15 minutes left in overtime.
Plenty of time left, and it's an absolute circus. So, game
so
finishes, we lose.
When it happened, were you like, okay, he called this, or was you like, or were you thinking there's got to be something to this?
When I first saw it, I said, great, Pete getting cute again.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm going to
Because everyone expects
everybody.
That.
I'm going to outsmart everybody, and I'm going to catch him by surprise kind of thing. And that's just something the Seahawks like to do, is at times they outthink themselves and get really cute.
Yeah.
Very similar to the Super Bowl play of, oh, we're going to sprint. On goal line, we're going to go 5 wide receivers, and we're going to trick the Patriots because they're going to come out in goal line.
Yeah.
We did. We had a good matchup. Like, terrible play call, though. Like, I'm going to throw a slow ball over the middle to Ricardo Lockett. Like, come on. If you want to do a sprint out and throw a safe ball to the sideline, I don't care. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
But the play call itself, you know, and I thought this again. Like, great, here we go again. The Seahawks outthinking themselves. We're just going to hand them the ball in the 50. Like, that was just a poor decision in my eyes. Now, fast forward post-game. Pete Carroll states.
And you're probably sitting there waiting on these post-game comments.
Oh, yeah. I was queued up. Like, come on. I got my skews ready. I'm ready to put you over the barbecue here, Mr. Carroll. They didn't onside kick. Yeah. They had no intention to onside kick.
And what the hell happened?
So, this is probably something we'll never get the real answer ever at this point.
Hauschka should write a book on this later.
Yeah,
life, but
seriously. So I've watched the play very closely, and the way he swings his leg through is like somebody swinging a sandwich. Like, it looked like he intentionally tried to just pop it up about 10, 15 yards. It wasn't like, oh, I got this big divot and I hit the ground and it just popped up. Like, now, what they've said is, hey, we had studied the film and we knew there was a hole of where they lined up, so most of their front linemen lined up 15 to 20 yards back. Well, an onside kick only has to go 10 yards. And then there was a gap from about 25 to 30 yards behind them where they figured we could drop in a ball and they're probably just going to recover it. we may have a chance to sprint down there and compete for the ball, so be it. But we're going to give him the ball on the 25, 30-yard line. We're very comfortable with that because we're keeping it out of Tavon Austin's hands, who's already returned one to the house on us.
Yes.
And we aren't going to risk it in overtime, so let's just put the ball there and let's start. We're good with it. No momentum. They just go fall on the ball.
But that's not what happened.
That's not even close to what happened. So I don't think we'll ever hear the story, right? Maybe where they were talking, hey, those guys are lining 15 to 20 yards back. We could onside kick here. Hey, we could go with the pooch kick. And whether that was a miscommunication between what Hauschka heard, oh, we're doing the pooch onside kick, okay. And you just, like, pop it up. Like, if he had done a little dribbler there and let our guys go compete for it, you might have looked at it and been like, damn, that was a good opportunity. That was close. But what he did was, like, the heck was that? You kicked the ball up in the air, like, right to the guy standing
It was like
there.
A bunt.
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah, terrible. I couldn't believe it. And when you had told me first thing Monday morning, that, hey, there may be more to this. But, yeah, I don't think we'll ever learn the real truth to this. Thing that got me most interested about this, and I didn't even fathom this happening, because if the Seahawks did lose, I didn't expect them to give up 34 points or whatever they gave up, you know, in over 350 yards. But this was what I thought. If they did lose this game and their defense played poorly, which, like I said, I never thought it would happen, but what would this mean with the Cam Chancellor status? Would this put a little fire under their bellies to get him? I was listening to Brock and Salk in Seattle on Monday morning, and Salk said he is going to hold steady on his take that absolutely not. They cannot make a move with Cam on this. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And they need to make it to where he gets sick to his stomach watching his teammates suffer without him. You know, the guy that is replacing him made his first ever start and gave up some big plays in a big play in a big time situation.
It's 24-31 with about a minute 30 to go. Lines up one-on-one with Lance Kendricks on the outside. Gets a turf monster. Yep. Falls down.
Wide open.
Not even like, oh, he dove, tried to make a good play. Like, literally just spins to turn and run with the tight end and falls down. And Foles throws this big old lollipop. Like, didn't even have to hit the guy in stride because our safety was like a salmon out of water.
Do you think this moves the needle for Seattle to make something happen with Cam?
Yeah, I don't think so at all, to be very honest with you. If Deion Bailey had got hurt and ended his season, maybe you get pressed more into a corner of, all right, we need a body. But they're going to, you know, whoever's here, we're going to ride and die with them. And, you know, Cam, if he wants to really take that stance and ride this out, I think where you've seen the most pressure come from is Paul Allen's pulled the plug.
Yeah.
He said, we will not pay this guy. We will not negotiate this way. We don't do our business this way. And so now I think you're seeing both sides starting to posture and say, no, this is not how we're going to do things. So, unfortunately, it's come to this, and it's pretty sad. I mean, he's a phenomenal player and somebody you'd love to have on the team. But
what is my situation here? What does this do for Cam? Does Cam come out of this now that he's seen this? Is it going to take a couple more weeks of bad defensive play? Hopefully not more losses for the Seahawks, but poor defensive play. And now not only are some local media coming out and lashing against Cam, one of the most respected football players of all time, Ray Lewis, kill him last night on air and say that his take on the Cam Chancellor situation is that he would never leave his brothers. Yep. Does any of this make Cam's needle move?
I don't know. You know, I know Cam cares a lot about his own beliefs, morals, and convictions. And when he gets set in his ways, he is all in on that being his way. So I don't know if this will move the needle or if Ray Lewis or other people saying things like that will actually help versus fuel the fire, or if he'll just tune them out. And, you know, nope, you don't know me. You don't know my situation. You don't know what I've played through, and I'm not going to risk not having any non-guaranteed money in year two and three, and this is when I'm taking a stance. I think most people have come out and said, Cam, you know, you made the wrong stand. You have 3 years left on the – if you want to do this next offseason, tell the Seahawks, hey, I'm going into that year with no guaranteed money now, and I got nothing next year, you probably could have made that move next year, and you probably could have got the Seahawks to – bump up some signing bonus to move some things around. But they can't do this with 3 years left.
Yeah.
Like, he just took the wrong stand at the wrong place at the wrong time, considering everyone they just had to pay. And now, what are we going to redo Earl Thomas next year?
Yeah.
Are we going to do Richard Sherman next year? We just signed these guys. Yeah. So, I think Cam made the mistake. He's not going to win. And this could be a bloody battle to the bitter end. You know, he wants to sit out 6-7 weeks and then come back to make sure he doesn't lose his whole league year. or this could wrap up in a week or two. But what's Cam going to be? He hasn't practiced football.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, he could come back, pop his hamstring, and just sit out the rest of the season. So yeah. If I'm the Seahawks, I have to be mentally strong, and I'm ready to move forward without Cam Chancellor the entire season.
It's getting to be more than just a business situation. It's starting to be like football situation here, like you said, if he's not physically in shape. It doesn't matter if you're working out seven times a day.
Completely different.
You got to have helmet and shoulder pads on to be ready to play, and you got to do it for a while. And then last question about the Seahawks game. A, are you feeling bad about anything? I know a lot of teams whose teams lost aren't feeling good about their situation. It is week one, but we are overreacting here. That's what we're doing. How do you feel about it moving forward? Or are you kind of, hey, sit and wait here the next couple weeks and see what we're like because of how bad you guys – or not how bad, but how the matchup always fits with the Rams?
Yeah, and it's one of those – I felt like we had an opportunity to get that win. And you know, the Rams made some plays down the stretch. They got the win. You chalk it up to, okay, they beat us this time. But I felt like, you know, we gave them those opportunities to beat us, and we made some mistakes down the stretch. Now, if we can take these and learn from them and move forward, great. Generally, I try to break the season into quarters.
Yeah.
Right? And chunk it down.
Last year's first quarter was terrible for the Hawks.
It was. We started 3-3 and finished 12-4. This year I had us with our first four games against Rams, Packers, Bears, Lions, coming out of that at 2-2. You know, if we could, you know, win one of the games on the road and make sure we at a minimum split the first two games at home, and we're sitting at 2-2 through the first four games, I think we're okay. And so, you know, if we can go steal the next week at the Packers and we got a little more fire in our belly because we lost this one, okay, so be it. We were sitting at 1-1 and we beat one of the top teams in the NFC, I'm okay with that. You know, we just got to move on to next week and get ready to go get one.
I feel like if you guys are able to fix the offensive line, it's going to help out a lot of things.
Yeah.
That the hope would be that you're able to put up more points.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the defensive situation is. It could just be that Nick Foles and everything was a new element to the Rams offense that no one had seen before, that new wrinkle of some of the new personnel and some things that they were doing. And the next time you guys play, you have film and other teams film against them, you're able to fix it. So I'm not sure about the defensive situation with Cam being out. I don't know if that's something we're going to see, you guys giving up 350 yards every game and 30-plus points. I haven't seen that in 6 years out of Seattle.
Yep.
So I think the thing moving forward is I don't know if you guys can go out and tick up the waiver wire and get some offensive linemen in there, or if Cables needs to work, 190-hour weeks for the next few weeks to get this thing fixed. But I do feel like if the offensive line gets fixed, it's going to help out a lot of things. But that's easier said than done.
So let's move to the early game on Monday night. And I think this was one of the ones everyone circled of, okay, here comes the shootout. Here are two teams. Let's get on the turf. Let's run. Let's gun. Let's go. Vegas had it slated as its highest point total projection in the entire NFL for week one. That would be the Eagles and the Falcons. Zach, what were a couple of things that jumped off the page to you when you watched the game?
Number one is Julio Jones.
Oh.
And you and I have been excited for Julio Jones on air for 25 weeks now.
Yes.
And off air for 12 months. And I thought he lived up to the billing. He scored two touchdowns. Every time he touched the ball, it was just freaky. And it's always been like that since high school.
Yeah.
And he's healthy Julio Jones. It doesn't get much better. It's must-see TV. Healthy Julio, and I'll say this now, is the best player in the National Football League. It's not even close. At 6'5", 6'6", he's got to be pushing 250 pounds. I'm not kidding you either. And it's all rock steel. It's not even rock solid. It is steel. And he still runs a 4.3, 4.4. Like, literally, you're talking about a possessed human being that doesn't want to do anything but go out and play good football. And he's seems to be a really good guy, all that type of stuff. So I root for the guy, and that's the number one thing that jumped off me. Number two, and these are things we'll dive into, are Eagles' lack of running game after they spent so much money, especially on their clear number one, DeMarco Murray. And you watch the game, you wouldn't even be able to tell he was the number one back. And then number two is Bradford was taking way too many hits for a banged-up quarterback already in his young career. If he continues to take hits like that, it's not going to work out well for the Eagles in that quarterback situation, and they'll be very glad they didn't sign him to an extension already. But that running game is definitely concerning, as DeMarco Murray had 8 rushes for 9 yards. He had negative 9 yards at halftime. They had more. They punted more than he had rushing attempts in the first half. He still scored 2 touchdowns, but, I mean, there's nothing to write home about, and they lost. Took everyone by surprise because of everyone was buying into Chip Kelly preseason type stuff where they're scoring all those points. And you know, they got the super roster here. Bradford's going to be transformed. And I didn't really like the things they were doing with Bradford. You know, Bradford wasn't protected. He's throwing more, you know, deep balls. The guys weren't getting open, forcing a lot of things, especially in the fourth quarter. That's late. A guy like Bradford, who hasn't played in a while, is thrown into a stressful Monday Night Football two-minute situation, and he's forcing the football and throw picks. And then I know you probably saw it, but for people that know football, one thing doesn't work for quarterbacks at any level, especially in National Football Leagues, when you stare down your wide receiver.
Very true.
And the safeties in the National Football League are going to pick that off every single time. And it took Will Allen about 3 minutes to pick up on that, and he was everywhere. If he wasn't intercepting or deflecting the pass, he was making a tackle. And he's a quality NFL safety, and he was all over the football field last night.
The one thing I thought was really interesting from the Eagles' offensive perspective was really how boring their offense was. Like, it was, okay, we're going to run zone left, zone right, pitch left, pitch right, as far as our running game. Like, you saw nothing between the tackles with any consistent fashion.
And they didn't do anything to, like, set up things in the future with the running game or their pass game.
Yep.
There was no threat of a play-action pass because the offense could not run the football.
Nope. And then when you went into the, you know, wide receiver game, it was either, you know, slow drags across the middle, tight end curls, or, you know, wheel routes to our running backs. Now, some of those things did work, but as far as what you think with Chip Kelly of, okay, we're going to be bubble screens, we're going to do, double moves, we're going to have three guys crossing and then throw down the backside. Like, there was nothing special or creative about the offense. Nelson Aguilar lined up across from Desmond Trufant and pretty much took a ticket and just sat down and watched the game.
Yeah.
You know, Desmond Trufant is not Richard Sherman by any means.
Looked like it last night.
But he only got one target, and is when he actually moved into the slot where he wasn't on Trufant anymore on the final drive in the fourth quarter. So you essentially cut the field in half right there because you didn't even target Aguilar on the outside. So I was just really confused with what the dynamic of the offensive, even if you want to go at them with a passing game plan, was for the Eagles when for the last few years we've just talked so much about this creative, genius offense, and it was just a mess.
Yeah, it's a mess and all types of things. I think a big factor in it, which holds it all together, and it all starts up front with the offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
You and I mentioned it on air a few times. We've definitely talked about it off air, and I don't think it's getting enough publicity out there. They got rid of the day they signed all three of those backs, because they signed them all like virtually in the same day or two.
Yep.
The day after they got or told Evan Mathis they weren't going to re-sign him. They were trying to trade him.
Yeah.
And he was, by Pro Football Focus, is number one or number two interior offensive lineman last year and number one rated run-blocking offensive lineman.
Right.
And the day you sign the NFL's leading rusher for millions of dollars, the next within 24 hours, you're telling the lead blocker on that offensive line he's got to go. Then you get rid of the guy on the other side, and all you're doing is keeping Jason Peters. And Jason Peters has had injuries in the past where he's not the all-pro left tackle that he once was. It's a mess. Like, Bradford, if you need anything up front, it's to protect your investments of, hey, this is an NFL-driven league. We've got to protect our quarterback, it could get off of the bus and twist his ankle, and we won't ever see him again. That's Bradford's luck with his injury and his health. And then running backs, who you're spending a lot of money on and you're basing your offense on. I don't care what you think about Chip Kelly's offense. His offense is based on the threat of the zone read with his running backs and the angles that they can take and how wide they can take it, which doesn't fit DeMarco Murray's running scheme at all, and we could spend a whole hour on that, but I don't want to. But you've got to have guys up front to, A, protect your quarterback and clear holes for your running backs. And he doesn't have that. And I don't think a lot is being said about that. But that's a clear issue for the Eagles moving forward. And would you agree with that? I mean, and then also Trufant played well and Byron Maxwell got blocked. Just it's almost like Dan Quinn, his former coach, who's now the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons, it's almost like he knows exactly what Byron Maxwell does.
Yeah, I will say their game plan for how they were going to attack Byron Maxwell, they just abused him. Whether it was, all right, we're going to put Roddy White and just drag him all the way across the field because we know he can't run laterally. We're going to send Julio Jones right at him, double move him, and just blast down the seam. We're going to get physical with him and push him around. He made one or two plays, but the other 14 or 15 were not a five-year, $90 million cornerback worthy contract. And that is exactly why he is not a Seattle Seahawk.
You texted me last night. You said that is why he's not a Seahawk.
So, Zach, let's move to a couple other games in which we had some revolving quarterback situations where the Browns, Mr. McCown thought he would do some Superman John Elway going into the end zone to win the Super Bowl. Oh, wait, it was week one.
And he got helicoptered.
Oh, man, he got...
He's too old for that.
No, yeah, you don't want to be doing that unless you're trying to win the Super Bowl. And so then we got Johnny Manziel coming in for the Browns.
Thrown into
up.
The fire.
Yeah, and what, first pass, throws a 60-yard touchdown, and we're like, here we go, we got Johnny football, and then he goes scrambling, and he gets lit up.
Yeah.
And you're concerned about him.
I thought Johnny played adequately. You know, if you follow the NFL at all, you know Johnny hasn't really practiced in the last 2 months because he's been healing up this elbow tendon. In his arm. And then he said in the postgame press conference, you know, Johnny's a completely different guy than he was in the past. And I would have loved to see him in the press conference after this with old Johnny, but I'm glad that this Johnny's out and about. I feel like he's a lot better for the game and everything that he represents. But he said after the game, he goes, you know, I haven't gotten a lot of reps this week or in the past 2 months, but still that's no excuse. I'm an NFL quarterback. I need to come in and be more productive. But it says a lot. You know, if he goes out of his way to make sure that we know he didn't take a lot of snaps this week, he's still really healing up that elbow. And it sucks because they signed McNown for a buffer here, mm-hmm. was to, A, start this entire year and continue to develop Johnny Manziel and then play him all next year to see if this is the route that they want to go with Johnny Manziel or if they need to move on, or to buffer him for the first 6 to 8 weeks. And once McNown, they get the first excuse to sit McNown and put Johnny in, develop Johnny for those first 6 to 8 weeks, and then put Johnny in and say, hey, let's evaluate this, see if this is the way we want to go. That's not what happened. Johnny, that lasts about a quarter and a half, and Johnny was thrusted in there and had to go at it right away. McCown had a concussion. He's probably going to be out next week. Johnny's going to play again, and then they're forced with the situation at week 3. Hey, do we want to bench Johnny again and maybe mess up his confidence? And then we're going to grade and evaluate our entire franchise moving forward on Johnny's play when he's not really ready yet? Or do we want to put McCown back in and go back to the original plan? Tough situation for the Browns here moving forward.
Yeah, huge question marks with the Browns moving forward. It'll be really interesting to see what they do when McCown is back healthy again and seeing how Johnny plays, how the elbow responds over the next couple weeks here, you know, now that he has to take first-team reps and be ready to rock. Second quarterback situation we had was with the Texans. The Texans just got obliterated
on the
offensive line by Houston, by Poe. They just got after Hoyer and were just tossing him like a rag doll. Now, if you look at the final score, it was not reflective at all of the way that game went with a couple late touchdowns scored by the Texans. So they decided to make the move and put Mallett in. I was a little surprised that Bill O'Brien had this quick of a hook to take Hoyer out, because I don't feel like it was all poor play on Hoyer's part.
He didn't look good, though.
He didn't look good, but I don't know that a lot of people around him gave him a lot of help to look that good either. So, but now, and this is what probably made me scratch my head more, it wasn't like, hey, we want to get Hoyer out there. We didn't want him to get beat up, give Mallett a shot. Game was, out of hand.
Yeah.
And so we're ready to move on to next week. Bill O'Brien turned this into, a chaotic mess by saying, I won't name a starter. You'll see Sunday.
Yeah.
And now everybody's going, oh, God, we're back to this quarterback controversy again.
Mallett, that was the fear of, like, do they put Mallett in? Okay, what if Mallett gets in and plays well because Kansas City's in prevent D, let's go home D.
Right.
Scores, rattles off 16 points there and gets it within striking range for the Texans late in the fourth quarter. And Bill O'Brien has now put himself and his team into a quarterback controversy. And I think Bill O'Brien thought for him and his team and the distraction, to limit distraction, hey, I know who the starting quarterback is going to be. I'm not going to tell anybody. You guys will find out Sunday, thinking that's the last you'll hear of it. No, that's not how this thing works in the NFL, Bill. And he's put himself into a quarterback competition when it didn't need to be an added stress and everything there. I like Ryan Mallett. He's my guy, but Brian Hoyer is going to be the starting quarterback, at least for a few more weeks, until, if this continues to be a shit show, he's going to have to put Ryan Mallett in.
Yeah, I agree. And so let's move on to, one of the last ones we highlighted. I had the Colts in my AFC championship game. You had them in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
They go into the Bills week one.
Not physical enough.
Put up a clunker,
man. They got out-physicaled and out-mentally toughed and out-psyched, everything. The Colts are going to be okay, though. Don't worry about the Colts because their division sucks. They're going to find a way to get in the playoffs, get a little confidence behind them, and you never know what can happen when you get in the playoffs. And plus, it's like anything. You start week one, show me this team in October, probably a completely different team, and they're firing all cylinders, most likely. That's what you would like to expect. But they're not physical enough, which is going to hurt them in cold weather games. And when they're going up to the East Coast to play these really good teams that are, you know, right up there with skill level with them, Buffalo is not matching with them with skill, but outplayed them and out-physicaled them. And that's what got them beat. But Indiana's going to be fine. They're going to win a lot of games because their division sucks.
And I think that was the one thing that surprised me the most was you bring in Frank Gore, you have Andre Johnson. Those two guys did nothing.
Yeah. Like, Andre looked old.
Yeah, like you anticipate Andre, like, hey, in a tough game like this, throw me the ball. Yeah. I'm going to go up and win. I'm going to run a stop route. I'm going to push off. I'm going to go win a slant. You know, get me six, seven catches, and even if it's for not 150 yards,
and they
but
had
just
like
moving chains.
And they had Frank Gore on like a pitch count. Like they didn't want to have him go over like 12 carries or something like that.
Yeah, I think he had 10 for 31 yards. Like, I mean, that is the exact style game you bring Frank Gore in for. Of, hey, we need to grind this. We're going to ground and pound our offense. We're not airing it out well. You know, Philip Dorsett has a fumble in the punt game. You know, Moncrief is still a young guy. Like, you don't have a ton of trust there. Yeah. You've got T.Y. Hilton who's coming off a concussion, so you don't want to be giving him a ton of balls and get him banged up and lose him for more weeks. So I felt like they just – what we thought was a team building up – you know, and adding more pieces, those pieces really didn't come to fruition in week one.
And now, this may be good for the Colts.
Absolutely. I think that's one of those teams that a loss in week one to a really good defensive team where you can go back to the drawing board and say, guys, this ain't going to work. We got to figure this out. Maybe that's good for them and kind of get a reality check. Because like you mentioned, they're going to win their division.
Yeah.
No question. Their division is just awful. Like Mariota may be sniffing it.
Let's not put Mariota in Canton yet, though.
No. I'm not. No. What I'm going to say is we probably had that team at 4-12.
Yeah.
You know, and seeing them come out and play and execute. Okay. We know they're going to be better than Texans. We know they're going to be better than Jacksonville.
They're not going to beat Indianapolis in Indianapolis.
No. They're maybe a 7-9 team next year. Yeah. Maybe we get them to 9-10 wins and they start taking steps forward. They still got an atrocious running game. They got a bad defense. Tennessee is not there yet at all.
Yeah.
But that's a team that's going to start taking strides towards it. So you know, okay, Colts got this. Whether they're an 8-win team, a 9-win team, 10-win team, they got it. What they need to be focused on is getting better every week, establishing a run game, moving the ball on offense, not relying on 50 throws from Andrew Luck every week because he's completing like 50, 55% of them. So I think they need to make some more strides there. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, like I said, they're going to be fine because of their division that sucks. Mariota thing's interesting. There's been a lot of people in life, not just football, that have come out in their first ever thing and done well, beginner's luck type deal. And, you know, Vince Young comes to mind. Vince Young had a really good rookie year. One rookie of the year was on cover of Madden and literally not heard from him since. So it would be interesting. Like, first week of October, I'd love to see, you know, look at these notes of what we had out of game week one in the first week of October, go back and look at, you know, how completely wrong we were or what we were right on too. So it'll be interesting moving forward. I thought the Bills, definitely interesting and huge game this weekend there in Buffalo as the Patriots come to town. Rex Ryan's hated rivalry with the Patriots. What seems like he's got a pretty good club there. Tyrod Taylor all aboard, choo-choo. I'm not buying in on the Tyrod Taylor hype train and probably never will. Maybe a little bit of beginner's luck, too, because there's not a lot of tape out there on Tyrod Taylor to prepare for.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll mention on those points, they're good ones, Zach, is we may not be putting Mariota in Canton, like you said, yet, but I'm more comfortable that I drafted Mariota than I drafted Jameis Winston after those week one performances right now.
I thought it was interesting because I thought that Mariota would have the better long-term career and Jameis would have the better year this year.
Mm-hmm.
But mainly because he's got Mike Evans and Vincent Jackson.
Yeah.
Mike Evans didn't play Sunday. And coming away from that game Sunday, I felt like I couldn't be more wrong, you know, about what I thought. Mariota set an NFL rookie record for throwing four first-half touchdowns, also tied a rookie record for first start, four touchdowns in your first game. He looked great, you know, and he's got weapons there too. But like I said, I just felt coming away from that game like I was really wrong with my predictions that, you know, Jameis would have the better year, but Mariota would have the better career. It looks like, and, you know, history tells us that if you're picking, you know, your top two quarterbacks, one is going to ultimately fail eventually, and one is going to be pretty good. And luckily we're not just banking it off of week one, because if so, Jameis would be heading to the house.
So when we come back, Zach, we're going to take a look at some of the fantasy outlook. We're going to stick here and stay in the NFL, but we're going to look at it from the fans' perspective. We're going to look at some of what our forecast was, some of what we're going to be forecasting into week two based on the results, injuries, and other factors. When we come back, we'll be here looking at the fantasy forecast right after this.
A history filled with tradition and excellence, passed on by those who came before us. The legacy is what drives us and brings us to the dawn of a new era. The future is now. Be there for the next chapter of Boston College basketball. Get your tickets now.
Welcome back, everybody. It is time again for our favorite weather meteorologist, Zach Spears, to hit us with the fantasy forecast. We're going to take a look at week one and where we may have hit some home runs, where did we swing and miss, and then, as always, we'll get into what week two 7-day forecast with some ice, ice, baby, and hot, hot, hot. So, Zach, looking back at some of your calls that you made last week, how did you do?
Well, I want to go ahead and highlight my first ever ice, ice baby.
Okay.
It was Randy Bullock, the kicker for the Texans.
Oh. I got to call this out. I made fun of you for this one.
Yes.
And that was also on the back of you calling Chase Daniels a sleeper, just to preface where your head was at. But you said, hey, I don't trust the Texans kicker. They're going to go for two more often than not. What happened?
He missed his first extra point of the season.
Oh!
Which, for everyone that listens to the show and is a part of the show, it was a very hilarious inside joke between us all, and I'm sure everyone got a laugh because I know you did. You texted me, and you were tripping out, loving it, as I did. I saw him miss it, and my first thought was like, I got to talk to Matt about this. It was hilarious. My fantasy team did well. I know people don't care that to talk about the other fantasy teams, but that all goes back to you as being my fantasy football consultant analyst for the show. I listen to all the things that you say, and I put it. I scored 170 points. I outscored everyone in the league by 45 points, and I'm 1-0. So thank you for that. Big days out of Julio, Matt Forte, and Tom Brady. And I had a buddy who drafted Gronk, 8th overall, totally paid off for him.
Yep.
30-point outburst from a tight end. He's going to be tough to stop this year.
He will. Any other people that you may have called or asked about last week on your Ice Ice Baby that I think one of them for you was Mike Evans. We had talked about extensively of do you start him, do you sit him? And I think we ultimately said sit him.
Yes.
Because we were concerned about even if he played, knowing Lovie Smith, he's going to have him on a pitch count. He won't have him do much. He'd be more of a lame duck decoy. So we said for everybody to sit Mike Evans.
And he was ruled out late, about 50 minutes before kickoff.
That was a 425 game.
Right.
So if you didn't have another late-end wide receiver, you were in trouble there.
Right, right. And I was concerned about that for some people. I don't have him on my team, but on my Sunday show, that's what I am. I'm in charge of getting fantasy updates and stuff out there. And I was making sure as soon as that news broke to let everyone out there know, hey, if he's on your team and he's slotted to start, get him out and get someone in if you can because he's not going to play. It sucks if you're a fantasy football player and you take it seriously that – some teams, for the competitive advantage, don't name a starter or don't name if the guy's going to play or not until late. But ultimately, that's why we play fantasy football, because these guys are out there playing and making a ton of money.
Yep.
Now, I have my this week's my forecast here, and I'm going to put it up to you, the analyst, and we'll see what you think about some of my thoughts here.
Let's do it.
Okay, so I'm going to start with hot this week. Tyrod Taylor, be a hot start or a hot pickup off the waiver wire?
Oof.
After his big week. He was accurate. He didn't throw for a ton of yards, but he's accurate and got completions and scored points.
Yeah. What the interesting with Tyrod Taylor is we'll see over time, does he start to run the ball more? Quarterbacks can score more points when they do add a running capability of 3, 4, 5 yards or points, you know, because you're getting 40, 50 yards. Well, that's another, you know, 200 or so passing yards. So Tyrod does bring that ability to the table. If I have a roster construction available where I could use a backup quarterback, maybe he's my safety net, a bye week quarterback, I'd snag him and put him on my bench. I feel good about that.
Okay, number two. With Dez Bryant's absence and a team
going to Philly this week that's probably going to put up points, would it be smart to, A, start Terrence Williams, who's probably going to see a lot more targets and catches, or at least pick him up on the waiver wire and play him somewhere in your lineup?
I'm not loving Terrence Williams. I thought he was actually going to have a bigger week this last week against the Giants. I thought, especially with Dez out there, they're going to roll extra coverage. I thought we would see kind of a coming out party.
And he did, but he dropped everything.
He did not have a good game. No. He did not look focused. He almost didn't look like he didn't want to be there. Now, he made some plays down the stretch to help get the win and get him in field goal range a couple times. I'm not selling the farm to go get Terrence Williams and start him immediately. If you have him, maybe you bench him and ride it out for a week or two and see if he does establish that. But him now getting number one coverage, I think this opens up more opportunity for both Witten, Escobar, Dunbar. I think those three guys are going to see much more consistent targets than it immediately boosts Terrence Williams into a number one guy.
And my final hot is the San Francisco defense shutting out or completely shutting down the Vikings offense, which we've been told and read about that's supposed to be prolific and be really good with Bridgewater at quarterback and Adrian Peterson's return. Shut them down, held them 3 points yesterday. Would that be a good pickup or a good start?
See, that one I'm probably going to go opposite with you. I'm not buying in to the 49ers team yet. I think this was more just a complete shambling game plan of the Minnesota Vikings. I think they had been talked up so much. They went in there, sweet, we got this win, this team's down. And that showed you in any given Sunday or Monday moment of somebody just played with more heart and will and beat you. And I think that's more of a gut check game for the Minnesota Vikings than it is an anointment of, hey, 49ers are still here. They're still good. You know, they still got a lot of holes on that team. They got a lot of question marks on offense. If you watch Kaepernick actually try to throw the ball, it was terrible.
Yeah.
Like they did not look good. Carlos Hyde carried them through that game. Their defense really didn't get challenged.
Yeah.
I mean, Teddy Bridgewater did not play well. AP wasn't comfortable running from the shotgun because he can't get a full head of steam. So there's a lot of question marks on what they're going to do going forward on Minnesota's side more than I'm anointing, man, this 49ers team looks great.
Okay. So now I'm going to go to my ice babies.
Okay.
Number one, and I never thought it would come to this, but I have to ask you. And I hate having to ask you this, but Seattle's defense, are they on the downward spiral as far as fantasy, at least for the next few weeks?
Here's the only reason I'd probably say no to you. You know, we live by the principle here at the Fantasy Forecast with Zach and Matt.
Start your studs.
Start your studs. And if you've drafted the Seattle defense, that probably means you took them as the number one or number two defense off of the board. You got to remember they have Ricardo Lockett, so you're getting special team points.
Yes.
He got you another punt return touchdown over the weekend. The guy is great. He could go off at any given time, so you got that going for you. Kerry Williams got a sack, forced fumble, fumble return for a touchdown, so they got a second score for you. So the Seahawks defense is still a turnover machine. I think, yes, they got some work to do as far as the points they're giving up, but they're still going to score. They got a really tough matchup going into Green Bay. You know, if you got somebody way better and you want to bench them for a week, okay. But those X factors of you never know who's going to get a touchdown when, I'm still starting a Seahawks defense if I have them.
Okay. And then my second ice baby. I knew this day would come, but I just hate to see it's here. Peyton Manning.
Ooh. Yeah.
Or is his day's done as a top level, a top tier fantasy football quarterback?
For me, this is all about what your expectations are. Yes, his days of 404 touchdowns every week, probably over. I think he still has the opportunity to be a serviceable starting quarterback of throwing for 250, three touchdowns a week. Now, you got to remember, he's in a Gary Kubiak system that wants to run the ball. They want to control the clock. They want to slow the game down. They're in this to win games, not to win fantasy games.
Yeah.
That's the big difference between the two. You're not going to see 50 touchdowns out of Peyton Manning. Now, one thing I will maybe calm everybody down who's a Peyton Manning owner, they were 1-for-4 in the red zone. So they did not score a lot of touchdowns.
But they had the opportunities.
They had a ton of opportunities, and Peyton Manning missed a lot of wide receivers. And it wasn't, and this is where I thought it was really comical, it wasn't him underthrowing or inaccurate. He was overthrowing people. Everyone's questioned his arm strength, and he was winging the ball around. So I think some of this will clean up as some of the rust kicks off here. him and Demaryius, I think, will get on a little bit more of the same page. Him and Emmanuel Sanders will start to tighten it up, and I think they'll get in a better groove and flow here. I still, you know, kind of question, what is going on with that running game? Because C.J. Anderson didn't look great. Hillman popped a few here and there. That running game is a little bit suspect, so this offense might morph a little bit more over time.
In my final one, I find this one almost comical. My final Ice Ice Baby is the big money running backs, specifically DeMarco Murray and Adrian Peterson. This is why I never take running backs early in the fantasy football draft, especially with my first overall pick, because there's no really formula anymore to know if your running back's going to be successful every single week. You know, you pretty much have an idea of the running backs that are going to be successful throughout the year, but it seems like some of those come in bunches or in certain quarters within the season. You can never get any consistency out of a running back for big-time points, what you would want out of your number one overall pick. These two guys, Adrian Peterson and DeMarco Murray, found that, you know, both did absolutely nothing as far as fantasy points for the most part. Would they be on a, you know, a downward trend for you as far as not necessarily cutting and not starting, but should you go out and try to find someone else for help at running back to pair along with that?
Here's a great opportunity, because I think there's a lot of fantasy owners that are in your mindset right now of, man, I draft Adrian Peterson in the first round. This guy stinks. He lost his step. He's no good. Or, I got DeMarco Murray in the second round. There's a timeshare. Sproles got all the carries. This is terrible. If you got somebody in your league that is of that mindset, this is a great trade opportunity.
Yeah.
You can probably get 80 cents on the dollar, right? I can go offer you up a Vincent Jackson maybe for DeMarco Murray. And there might be some people that say, hey, you know what? I needed a stud wide receiver. I'll take him. Hey, I'll take Mike Evans for Adrian Peterson. You might have an opportunity here to upgrade.
These
guys, over, and like you mentioned, over the course of a long season, are going to get their numbers.
Yes.
They had a struggle and some tough matchups in week one. I trust these guys to be getting in the end zone every week. And that's one of the kickers with your star running backs, is they're going to consistently keep scoring for you.
Okay, then what's fantasy football forecast you have for us? What's your outlook looking for the next the game in 2 days on Thursday, and then we roll into the weekend?
Yep. So let's start with the game in 2 days, right? I mentioned this just a minute ago. I'm pretty ice cold here on the running back situation in Denver. C.J. Anderson was anointed the running back. You and I had talked extensively about Hillman being a potential guy to surmount him. C.J. Anderson's a little dinged up coming off a short week. I don't feel comfortable starting him, especially with Hillman nipping on his heels to steal some more carries. I'm avoiding the Denver running back situation on a short week on the road going to Kansas City. A couple of my hots. Last week, I was huge thumbs down on LeSean McCoy. Very similar reason for Mike Evans coming off the hamstring injury. We didn't know how much work he was going to get. He got an adequate amount. He got 14 carries, only got 41 yards. So if you sat him, you were a genius. Good job. Way to listen to our podcast.
Yes.
Now, coming into week two, Bill's got a good matchup here going against the Patriots.
Yeah.
The way they're going to win this game is similar to how Rex Ryan's won it before. We are going to ground and pound the snot out of the Patriots. D'Angelo Williams ran for 131 yards against that Patriots defense. LeSean McCoy has a very similar opportunity here going into week two. I'm all over LeSean McCoy having a big bounce back week, more confidence in the leg being a week healthier, him coming out, look for 100 yards, look for a touchdown on LeSean McCoy. My final one is I'm starting every Saints player that I got.
Why is that?
They had a rough week against Arizona.
Yeah, they did. Who are they playing this week?
They're teeing up a home game against Tampa Bay.
Okay, yeah. Well,
I see Drew Brees just lighting up the scoreboard. I see Brandon Cooks getting back after it. I see Mark Ingram getting in the end zone a couple times. This is going to be one of those, we're sending a message, we're not dead. We're not second-guessing Jimmy Graham being gone. I think they come out and hang a lot of points against that Tampa Bay team.
Agreed. Tampa Bay gave up a ton to a rookie quarterback last week. And Lovie Smith still has, say, a lot of work to do installing his defense and his mind frame into that defense. I would agree.
I totally agree, Zach. So let's catch another quick break here. I think this was great NFL talk today, Zach. When we come back, I want to take a look at your early season Heisman predictions. Who you got, who you circling, who you watching over the next couple weeks. And then we'll check up on a couple other news and notes from around college football right after this.
I want to go to Iowa State so I can study human diseases. and how to make people healthier. Maybe I'll try photojournalism. Whatever my adventure becomes, it sounds awesome.
Enjoy your adventure at Iowa State. Visit chooseyouradventure.net.
Welcome back, everybody. Zach, we're in the meat of what I'm going to call the NCAA college football season.
Yes.
We still got a couple cupcake matchups for some teams going into this week before we hit full-on conference play, but we had some good matchups over the weekend. Probably the biggest one everybody circled was the Michigan State-Oregon game.
Yes.
We had two top 10 teams facing off, but let me tell you, that may not have been the game of the weekend.
What was?
As we had Auburn,
yeah,
taking on Jacksonville State,
as we all predicted,
and
that was all of our number two game of the week. We all agreed before.
They took them to overtime. Yeah. Like number six team in the country, just completely struggling at home all four quarters, and even struggling in overtime, finally ekes out a win here. So, what did you catch anything else from the weekend of college football that jumped off the page at you? Big news and notes.
The big thing that jumped out to me. Back to that Michigan State-Oregon game. Oregon is not the Oregon we all know and love of the last 5-6 years anymore with this quarterback.
I was going to say, that's the big thing.
Yeah. Everyone else around Oregon is the same Oregon we all know and love except for the quarterback. And it makes you really think that this quarterback was FCS quarterback for a reason. And he's not an Oregon-type quarterback. He's more of a pocket passer. You know, he has the ability to run but doesn't really do it that well. And now he's got a fractured finger and they don't know if he's going to be able to play. And it really makes you think as well, how bare is that cupboard now that if they had to go seek out an FCS-level quarterback, that's not really the Oregon offensive-style quarterback. And if he is injured and out, what are they going to go to? Because it can't be pretty if this is what they resorted to. And everyone asked me, well, how can that be? They've had several years to develop a quarterback. I'll tell you how that could be, because the quarterback developer is in Philadelphia now. Mm-hmm. He's the head coach of the Eagles. He was the one prospecting, getting kids in that fit his mold, developing them for 2 to 3 years, and then playing them into the quarterback. There's a lot to be said for developing players, especially quarterbacks in college football.
Now, we talked a little bit about this during our SEC segment a couple weeks ago. One of the challenges I think college football teams at a major Division I level are having right now is getting kids to come in when they know, okay, I'm going to sit behind Marcus mm-hmm. Mariota for 2 years, or, hey, I'm going to sit for 3 years because there's this guy, then this guy, then this guy. Then maybe I'll get a shot for a year or two. And they're just going, okay, I'll go to Tulsa.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'll go to Cal because I can wing it over there. Hey, I hear ASU's got a senior graduating. I'll go down there.
Yeah.
So while I think Oregon brings in some phenomenal athletes, the quarterback position is probably one that may be a challenge for them to recruit. Because even though they turn them out to the NFL, while they're there, I don't want to go sit behind this guy.
Yeah, but the thing you got to remember about what Chip Kelly did with his quarterbacks, he recruited a lot of like safeties and wide receivers and guys that had played quarterback at some point in, or were playing quarterback in college, in or quarterback in high school and junior college, but were being recruited at the next level to play safety or wide receiver or something like that. And that's how we got their eye was, A, we win. Hey, we turn out quarterbacks. We got cool facilities and uniforms. But also, we're the only one that's going to play you quarterback. And then you're saying, well, how can he win? How can he develop these guys into that? Because that's what Chip Kelly does. He develops them and molds them into a perfect fit for his offense. He knows what he was looking for. And that's not there anymore. And that's how he was able to get those freaky athletes to fit the exact mold. And what that was drop back, go through the progression, nothing's there, I'm taking off running. And I'm going to do damage when I take off and run. Or we're going to do my killer zone read, and I'm a threat in the zone read. I'm not just going to hand it off. The running back's not the only threat. I'm a threat as well. Vernon Adams is not that anymore. So they've lost that entire dynamic to their offense. Now, Vernon Adams can continue to develop throughout the year and get this team into the playoffs, as they're still probably my favorite to win the Pac-12 and have the opportunity to play in that playoff. But I feel like if Chip Kelly were there, I'd feel a lot better about this Vernon Adams situation and experiment than I do without Chip Kelly there.
Okay, that's fair enough. Any big matchups coming up this weekend that you've circled on the docket for yourself, Zach?
Well, this is so cliche, but Toledo and Iowa State. And Iowa State has impressed me the first 2 weeks, which I don't say a lot. I don't say that a lot. And Toledo definitely impressed as they beat a top 25 ranked Arkansas at in Little Rock last weekend.
Yep.
It's interesting to see how good Toledo is, which will tell us a lot about Arkansas. And then I can finally start to really gauge Iowa State. They beat a decent Northern Iowa team 2 weeks ago, played really well for the most part against what seems to be a good Iowa team that's getting some top 25 ranking votes now. And we'll be able to see. The game is on the road in Toledo, so that's a game that I have my eye on. And then also, obviously, the Notre Dame-Georgia Tech game. We're going to see how good Notre Dame is.
There's a big question for you.
We're going to see how good Notre Dame is in their defense and see if someone can stop this veer and option, triple option attack that Georgia Tech's bringing in. Georgia Tech wins this game, I think you can likely see them in the top 10 because the game is in South Bend.
Yeah, two other ones that I had circled, Alabama at home against Ole Miss. I think
Ole Miss has been scoring a ton of points.
Yeah, this will be an interesting one to see kind of this may be the first one where Phil Coker gets tested.
Yeah.
He needs to put the ball in the air. He's got a tough SEC opponent coming into his house, but they may continue to rely on the run.
Yep.
Tough defense. Hopefully get the win at home. UCLA and BYU. UCLA all of a sudden has been anointed into a top 10 team. I don't know that they've been really challenged yet. BYU's won a couple.
They've won both on prayers.
Yeah, and finding ways to win. I don't know that they're number 19 team in the country. This might be one where UCLA wins and moves into the top 10, and you're kind of like scratching your head when you look back on this and go, how did they end up in the top 10 already?
Yeah.
So those are a couple games I probably got circled on my radar.
One more on my radar that I just thought of. It's not one that's going to you're not going to carve out time to watch it, and it's not going to light up your eyes or anything like that, but it could bring back a lot of good memories. Miami and Nebraska in Miami.
Ooh,
the old matchup of the 90s powerhouses there, and what used to be when I was growing up, when you were growing up, watching the cream of the crop in college football. Now both teams are a little bit fallen from graces. Nebraska is a little bit closer to the top of the tier than Miami is now. Miami has a lot of stuff going on and have for a while since they've been in trouble. But interesting matchup.
Yeah, totally agree. So, Zach, let's talk about some individual players. Let's talk about some Heisman favorites. Who do you got right now? Maybe your top two, top three, kind of Heisman front runners right now on your list.
Well, I'll give you my two front runners and then a sleeper.
Okay.
So two of the three guys on my list, you won't hear anyone else. And I've done a lot of research on everyone else's Heisman list to see this. I've been trying to get some be very out there and open thoughts with my Heisman picks. Now, these will range week to week. You won't probably see some of these guys in there anymore. But number one is Derrick Henry, the running back from Alabama. Everyone has him in their Heisman rankings. We saw him just kill Wisconsin the other day. He's averaging almost 8 yards a carry, has 6 touchdowns, and he's run for almost 250 yards on the season through 2 games. My number two is a guy that's not on anyone's ranking, but his name is William Likely. He's a defensive back for Maryland, but I like him as a kick returner and punt returner. He has 2 punt returns for a touchdown already. He's averaging 16 yards per punt return, which if you do the math, he's catching it right around the goal line or at the 5. He's getting you past the 20, around the 25-yard line, which is fantastic for what you want, but he's taking 2 to the house. He's a threat. Then also, that's his punt returns. And then also, as a kickoff return, he's averaging 28 yards per return and has almost 1,300 return yards this season already with 1 kickoff return for a touchdown. Now my sleeper. This is where it gets really interesting, and I've fallen in love with this kid. His name is Willie Quinn. He's a wide receiver, kickoff return specialist, and punt return specialist for Southern, the HBC school. And he lit it up on Thursday night on ESPN, and I looked up his stats, and he killed it in the first game. Not only did he run a reverse pass for a touchdown that he threw 90-yard touchdown pass, he's 1 for 1, 90 yards for a touchdown this year. He threw the ball 60 yards in the air. He's 5'6", 150 pounds probably. He threw that 90-yard touchdown pass, has 1 punt return for a touchdown, and 2 kickoff returns for touchdowns already. And we're talking 2 games through the year. And his punt return for a touchdown, if you haven't seen it, go look it up. Willie Quinn, Southern University punt return for a touchdown. Breaks 8 tackles and then jumps and flips over the final defender to get into the end zone. Fantastic. He deserves to be on everyone's Heisman watch list until he proves otherwise. You won't hear William Likely or Willie Quinn on anyone else's Heisman watch list except for here.
I love it, Zach. Those are great picks. I think I had a very similar one with Derrick Henry. I think, you know, we talked about this earlier during both March Madness, during, you know, throughout the summer, you got to be on a winning team to be in a Heisman or an MVP type conversation. So I think Derrick Henry is just going to be riding to the top, already scoring 6 touchdowns in 2 games. I mean, he's going to be a beast throughout the entire season. I still got Zeke Elliott on my list.
Yeah.
He's at 223, 4 touchdowns. I think Ohio State, again, is going to be in that top 4 conversation, and he's going to be scoring and driving
the team forward. And it's going to help drive his Heisman nomination.
Yep. And you'll see a theme for me. I think this is going to be the year of a running back. I think we've had a quarterback run here. I don't know if I got any one quarterback right now.
I don't feel like there's any elite quarterback. You know, Connor Cook and Christian Hackenberg's name keeps getting thrown around, but I'm not seeing it. I can see them project at the next level, but not as far as being the most dominant player in college football. Yeah.
The guy that I think took a step backwards, and I think now, I don't know if sleeper is the right word anymore, Royce Freeman. I think he had a stage against Michigan State. If he had gone out 150, couple touchdowns, and just really attacked a premier defense
on the road,
that he could have vaulted himself from, you know, in the conversation to number one leader in the clubhouse. You know, because you mentioned Vernon Adams is not a phenomenal quarterback. He's dinged up, and they needed to rely on Royce to have a big game. 24 carries for 92 yards. Not going to get it done in the prime time with the lights are on. Yeah. I think he's still out there on the list, but I think he's going to have a kind of a chink in his armor here unless Oregon can find a way to get in the playoffs and he can rebound against another major defensive team down the stretch. Zach, let's get out of here calling our shot. What do you got?
I have, as I always like to go to baseball for the time being, because my Rangers are relevant. The Rangers are in a tough 4-game series. They won game one last night to pull within half a game of the Astros. If you've listened to this podcast for a while, we've been kind of keeping track on this. And I feel like this time next week, the Rangers will be in sole possession of first place in the American League West. And they're going to do that by taking 3 of 4 in Arlington from the Astros this week. And hopefully by the time we're on air next week, they're able to maintain some form of lead so I can hold my call your shot and take it on home.
All right.
What about you? What do you got?
Right before we came on air, University of Texas decided to fire their athletic director.
Yes.
I think you and I have talked about this on air. I think this will be the nail in the coffin for Charlie Strong.
Yes.
I don't think they're going to go hire an AD that's a Charlie Strong guy. I think somebody's going to want to bring in their own personnel. And I think this also could be, you know, the basketball coach, kind of putting him on ice a little bit because he's kind of been, you know.
Well, they fired that basketball coach. They fired Barnes.
Oh, they did fire Barnes? Well, I called my shot. Yeah, I was right on top of it.
They got Shaka Smart. Remember the VCU?
Obviously, they got Shaka. So I was just.
But, yes, they would have. This AD, that's part of the reason why they didn't. That's part of the reason why they wanted to fire this AD because he didn't want to get rid of Rick Barnes for his lackluster performances in the tournament with a stellar recruiting classes and roster. You're dead on.
See, there you go. So that's why you tune in to listen to me call my shot about University of Texas athletics because I nail it every time.
But the Charlie Strong thing is very true. If Charlie Strong wins 5-6 games, which it looks like that's what's going to happen, he could be gone already.
This could be a tough season for them. So, everybody, we want to thank you for tuning in again. We're having a great time here sharing our wealth of knowledge about NFL.
Wealth of knowledge.
And
we're just throwing that term out there, apparently.
Yeah, you know, why not?
Hey, it's your birthday this week.
It is my birthday week. So we'll be celebrating Thursday, do a little lunch special, and get after that. And as always, feel free to download from iTunes, listen on SoundCloud, share with your friends and family members. We appreciate all the feedback and positivity everybody's given us. This is The Big Show with Matt and Zach. We'll see you next time. We're out. Your followers need to get your dollars up. Yeah, I'm tired of giving advice. Sometimes I look outside to see just am I living my life right. Electrifying rappers brought my cat to the knife fight. Who gon' win? It's obvious we all gon' sin, but I'm gone. Yeah.